Hello and welcome to Patron Deities, a show about deities for my patrons. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the Deities and Demigods supplement for Advanced Dungeons & Dragons 1st Edition, and talking about the gods, heroes, and legendary beings that I find in it, and how to use them, and religion and mythology more generally, in your fantasy role-playing game. If this is your first episode of Patron Deities, welcome. I'll start by giving you a little bit of background about the show. As you may know, I am the host of a podcast called Monster Man, in which I talk about the monsters of the gaming supplements of yesteryear. It's not necessarily intended only for people who play older editions of Dungeons & Dragons. I don't. I play 5th edition. It's more about using those older materials as inspiration and fuel for your game, whatever game you play. And I have this companion podcast called Patron Deities, which is the same thing, but for religion and mythology, in the form of the old Deities and Demigods supplement. There have been a number of seasons. I think this is our 5th season of Patron Deities. It's available to anyone who backs the Monster Man Patreon at the $2 or higher level. And every so often, I like to make episodes of Patron Deities available on the main free Monster Man feed, you know, so that people can listen to it and see if they like it. As this is the beginning of a new series, and as that series is the Cthulhu Mythos, which is a little bit of an unusual section of the Deities and Demigods book, I thought this would be a good one to do. So, let's get started. The Cthulhu Mythos section is one of a number of sections that appear in the first and second printings of the Deities and Demigods book, but not in the third and later ones. And there's a great article that really outlines the details of the conflict that caused this, and I don't want to rehearse the ins and outs of it here, other than to say that the copyright status of the works of H.P. Lovecraft was quite ambiguous, but in a way that I think people didn't fully appreciate until later, right? Arkham House, the publisher who licensed the rights to TSR and to Chaosium, claimed that they had the copyright, and no one saw any reason to disbelieve them. But the point is that following a copyright claim after the first edition came out from game publisher Chaosium, who would of course go on to make the Call of Cthulhu role-playing game in 1981, TSR decided to, you know, err on the side of caution and leave the Cthulhu Mythos and other licensed material out of the third and later editions. Indeed, the second printing has a disclaimer at the beginning saying that the Cthulhu Mythos material is used with permission, and then the third printing, which is the one that I have, has the disclaimer, but none of the material. Now, as I said, my copy of Deities and Demigods is a third printing, and it doesn't have any of the Cthulhu Mythos stuff, but some listeners of the show were kind enough to send me images of their first edition copies so that I could talk about them. If you're a modern gamer, Cthulhu is everywhere. And I don't just mean in games like Call of Cthulhu, or Trail of Cthulhu, or Achtung Cthulhu, or Delta Green, or The Fall of Delta Green, or The Cthulhu Hack, or Cthulhu Dark, or board games like Arkham Horror, or Elder Sign, or Mansions of Madness, or I don't know, is there a Munchkin Cthulhu? I'd be astounded if there weren't. Cthulhu is everywhere, in matters big and small. But that wasn't really true in the late 1970s. When we look at Deities and Demigods, we have to remember that we're looking at a book that was being written as H.P. Lovecraft's work was beginning to become popular again. You know, Lovecraft's work was published mostly during the 20s and 30s in pulp magazines. He was popular with a hardcore of fans, but he never really developed a substantial following. People who liked Lovecraft tended to like him a lot, but not all that many people liked Lovecraft. After Lovecraft's death in 1937, two of his correspondents formed a publishing company, Arkham House, with the intention of keeping his work in print, but it took some time, and they were, again, kind of small runs, mainly aimed at collectors. And it wasn't until the kind of paperback fantasy boom that Lovecraft started to get into more people's hands. I mean, Lovecraft appears in Appendix N of the Dungeon Master's Guide as one of the pieces of recommended reading, which is weird because his fiction has no obvious relationship to Dungeons & Dragons, which I think is yet again one of those things that suggests that early D&D was not yet the kind of brand that we expect, that it was much more diverse in what it was intended to be its application. Anyway, so we're dealing with a world where it would not surprise me to find out that for a lot of people in 1980, the Cthulhu Mythos section of the Deities and Demigods book was their first exposure to the Cthulhu Mythos. This is not like today where everybody kind of knows the basic outline. If you're a geek, if you exist in gamer circles, you are at least familiar with the basic outlines of the Cthulhu Mythos. You've heard of H.P. Lovecraft, even if you've never read any of his work. But I think for a lot of people in the 80s, that wasn't as true. Certainly my introduction to Cthulhu mythos was through gaming, specifically through Call of Cthulhu. And I think that's true of a lot of people. I think, you know, gaming has been an important force in bringing H.P. Lovecraft to the popularity that he now enjoys. This is also the first section of the Deities and Demigods book that we have covered that covers a fictional mythology. It's not the only one. It's just the first that we've done so far. So this is going to pose somewhat different challenges from the previous sections, which have, of course, been based on real-world mythology. So let's take a look at what authors James Ward and Rob Kuntz have to say about the Cthulhu mythos. The section begins with a short introduction that summarizes the history of the mythos. It talks about H.P. Lovecraft. It says, Lovecraft began referring in his horror stories to a pantheon of beings known as the Old Ones, who had descended to Earth from the stars in pre-human times. Says that they had a conflict with an unspecified race called the Elder Gods. They're, you know, the Old Ones are imprisoned, weakened, but not dead. And that they may one day return. And then it actually goes into some detail about the different interpretations of the Cthulhu mythos, including the more kind of good versus evil structure that August Derleth wanted to impose on it. Then it talks about cults of the Great Old Ones, which either await or attempt to hasten the return of their masters. Now, the concept of the Cthulhu mythos actually is not something that H.P. Lovecraft originated. It's a later term used to describe the quote-unquote mythology established in Lovecraft stories. And I say quote-unquote because, in fact, Lovecraft has more like a collection of aesthetic elements which he recycles to create certain effects, not always the same ones. You can see this in particular with Lovecraft's book, The Necronomicon, which plays very different roles in the different stories in which it appears. At times it's a collection of magic spells, at times it's a secret history of the earth, at times it seems to be some kind of devotional text. That's not uncommon for Lovecraft. He was not attempting to be consistent. Indeed, what he was attempting to do was to create the same sense of, the tiny fragments of things that are mentioned in his fiction being the, the tips of the iceberg of this, you know, whole other cosmology, but without actually creating the iceberg, because who needs it? So Lovecraft did expand his fictional cosmology in some of his stories, but it's important to remember that this was never intended to be an act of world building, and that the shared elements of the Cthulhu mythos between different writers such as Lovecraft, Clark Ashton Smith, Robert E. Howard, and Frank Belknap Long were not intended to be shared setting stories or anything like that. They were just authors who were friends reusing elements from each other's stories because they thought they were cool. Now, I believe that this spirit of shared creativity is actually very relevant to the experience of playing role-playing games. In fact, in many ways, the Cthulhu mythos, being fictional, is rather better suited to a Dungeons & Dragons game than any of the real ones that we've encountered so far. So what we see in the Cthulhu mythos is a collection of names, of ideas, and of images that play well with, that are derived from the creations of multiple authors, principally, but not only, Lovecraft. Some of these are derivative, others are highly original. There are no rules, at least no spoken rules. But one of the most important things about the Cthulhu mythos was that it provided a change from the dominant Gothic modes of horror. So there are no vampires in the Cthulhu mythos, no werewolves, no ghosts. None of the monsters that had, by Lovecraft's time, become familiar and friendly rather than eerie and unsettling. Now, as it happens, this has kind of happened to the Cthulhu mythos as well. It was listener Steve Dempsey who once said to me, Cthulhu is scary like Dracula is scary, that is, he isn't. I don't know if I would necessarily go that far, but I think it's a good point. We don't think Dracula's scary, we think Dracula's cool, or funny. But in Lovecraft's day, the Cthulhu mythos was an attempt to create something that was really outside of human experience, not allegedly outside of human experience, but actually very human in its structure. So the gods and beings of the Cthulhu mythos have concerns that are not antithetical to the concerns of humanity, but outside it. They are truly alien. They don't care about us. They see us as obstacles to their plans, perhaps, or perhaps they don't see us at all. They are the living embodiments of an uncaring universe in which human intentions, human desires, human feelings have absolutely no significance. So it would seem like this poses a number of problems for using the Cthulhu mythos in your Dungeons & Dragons game, right? First, I don't know that players necessarily want to be battling a nihilistic cosmos, although in the final episode of this season I'm going to have some thoughts about this, because actually I think players are maybe okay with that idea, maybe more okay than you might tend to think. But secondly, the Cthulhu mythos is supposed to be an alternative to werewolves and ghosts and skeletons and so forth. But Dungeons & Dragons has all of those things. It's crucial about Cthulhu that Cthulhu's real and Zeus isn't. Mankind made up friendly gods with human faces and ex-wives and stuff to be familiar and comforting. That's not real. What's real is Cthulhu. What's real is Azathoth. You know, your real god is a mindless, random creature, just like the universe you live in. So how do we reconcile this with a world of magic and whatever? How do we reconcile this with a fantasy Dungeons & Dragons or other fantasy RPG setting? Because obviously the, you know, what part of the horror of the mythos is that it's the reality that is under the skin of our reality. Peel back the boring and mundane reality and you find not wonder and delight, but just limitless nihilistic horror. And obviously that's not going to be true in the case of a D&D game, right? I mean, Cthulhu's just some dude with 400 hit points. 400 hit points is a lot. I wouldn't mess with him if I were you. But he's merely one among many deities. Or, well, that's up to you as DM to decide, but you know what I mean. And I'm going to suggest in this section that I don't really think that makes all that much difference. And I think in play, we're going to see that it is possible to, like, aesthetically distinguish the Cthulhu mythos from the other deities of your pantheon, even though, cosmologically, that makes no sense whatsoever. But if you are running a fantasy role-playing campaign, this is not the first thing you've done that makes no sense whatsoever, but it's still effective. That ties into my next pledge. Now, I wouldn't go so far as to say that I am a Lovecraft scholar, but I've given talks about Lovecraft, I've written articles about Lovecraft and the mythos in general, and, you know, I do sometimes find the proliferation of cuddly Cthulhu and understandings of Cthulhu as something other than what Lovecraft wrote about frustrating. And I pledge at this moment that I am going to abandon all my Lovecraft purism right here. We are going into this deities and demigods section, and we are going full gonzo. This is going to be pulp adventure. If we were going to be doing a serious Lovecraftian exercise, we wouldn't be playing barbarians and rangers and rogues and stuff, right? We would not have started this. There is another role-playing game that is about the Lovecraftian experience. It's great, and there's nothing in the world stopping you from playing it. So what we're gonna do is not see how can we make Dungeons & Dragons into a Lovecraftian game, but what can we take from the Cthulhu mythos to enhance our Dungeons & Dragons games, or our fantasy role-playing games in general. And okay, along the way, we're going to talk about the history and literature of the Cthulhu mythos, because, I mean, it's me, and you wouldn't be listening to this if you weren't interested in that kind of stuff, I suppose. So we're going to talk about it, but I always want us to bear in mind that we are taking this thing, and instead of saying, you know, what can we do to turn this into an occult mystery that ends with a sanity-shattering revelation, we say, what can we do to bring this eerie, uncanny atmosphere to our fantasy adventure games? Because I think there's plenty of room in there. But that doesn't mean that we're going to treat the Cthulhu mythos like any old pantheon, right? We're not going to just have Cthulhu be the same as Enlil or whoever, or otherwise what would be the point? We chose the Cthulhu mythos for our game because we wanted to do something a little bit different. So we're going to have to walk a fine line between treating the gods and monsters of the Cthulhu mythos like any other old gods and monsters to be destroyed, and treating the gods and monsters of the Cthulhu mythos like the gods and monsters of the Cthulhu mythos in a way that just undercuts the idea of a fantasy adventure game. Okay? So that is the philosophy of this season. Now, let's put it into practice. We're going to begin by talking about, you guessed it, Cthulhu, the lead-off deity in this section. So, pantheons and deities and demigods typically start with that pantheon's supreme deity, who's usually represented as a big tough dude with 400 hit points. And that applies here to Cthulhu. Another instance of how deities and demigods kind of works on wrestling or superhero comics logic, because there's no sense in which Cthulhu is the supreme deity of a pantheon. There isn't a pantheon, he isn't a deity, and if there wasn't, he wouldn't be the supreme one. He's just the best known, and therefore he gets top billing over obviously much more important characters. That to one side, what can we say about Cthulhu? Cthulhu, of course, appears in the H.P. Lovecraft story, The Call of Cthulhu. The story was first published in 1928. It was written in 1926, but not published until 1928. And it's an interesting story in terms of its structure. It's this very nested narrative. It's someone talking about the collection of documents he found, which often in turn refer to other documents, And it's all basically, it's a lot of different sources that each see a piece of the puzzle of this world-spanning cult of Cthulhu and the idea that this creature, which is sleeping at the bottom of the ocean, is going to rise again. And of course, this culminates in Cthulhu rising, but being destroyed, or at least, actually being sort of temporarily weakened so that he returns to his sleeping state. The actual action of the story of the Call of Cthulhu is not terribly exciting, so I think it's the idea of Cthulhu that really makes it effective. You know, Cthulhu appears, or is referred to anyway, in a dream had by an artist, and it soon becomes clear that actually lots of other kind of, I guess the idea is that as an artist he's sort of psychically sensitive, and the dream is of the lost city of Rillier, which the description is pretty good. Upon retiring, he had had an unprecedented dream of great cyclopean cities of titan blocks and sky-flung monoliths, all dripping with green ooze and sinister with latent horror. Hieroglyphics had covered the walls and pillars, and from some undetermined point below had come a voice that was not a voice, a chaotic sensation which only fancy would transmute into sound, but which he attempted to render by the almost unpronounceable jumble of letters, Cthulhuftach. And we later get a more detailed elaboration of the mythology of the Great Old Ones from one of their worshippers. He says, "These Great Old Ones were not composed altogether of flesh and blood. They had shape. For did not this star-fashioned image prove it? But that shape was not made of matter. When the stars were right, they could plunge from world to world through the sky, but when the stars were wrong, they could not live. But although they no longer lived, they would never really die. They all lay in stone houses in their great city Rillier, preserved by the spells of mighty Cthulhu, for a glorious resurrection when the stars and the earth might once more be ready for them. But at that time, some force from outside must serve to liberate their bodies. The spells that preserved them intact likewise prevented them from making an initial move, and they could only lie awake in the dark and think, whilst uncounted millions of years rolled by. They knew all that was occurring in the universe, but their mode of speech was transmitted thought. Even now they talked in their tombs. When, after infinities of chaos, the first men came, the Great Old Ones spoke to the sensitive among them by molding their dreams, for only thus could their language reach the fleshly minds of mammals. Then, those first men formed the cult around small idols which the Great One showed them, idols brought in dim eras from dark stars. That cult would never die till the stars came right again, and the secret priests would take Great Cthulhu from his tomb to revive his subjects and resume his rule of Earth. The time would be easy to know, for then mankind would have become as the Great Old Ones, free and wild and beyond good and evil, with laws and morals thrown aside, and all men shouting and killing and reveling in joy. Then the liberated Old Ones would teach them new ways to shout and kill and revel and enjoy themselves, and all the earth would flame with a holocaust of ecstasy and freedom. Meanwhile, the cult, by appropriate rites, must keep alive the memory of those ancient ways, and shadow forth the prophecy of their return." Well, okay then. There's a wonderful article from 1993, appeared in the magazine The Unspeakable Oath, by Dean Shamshak, in which he talks about kind of the symbolic power of the different Old Ones. And he says some great things about Cthulhu. And he talks about the idea that Cthulhu is full of paradoxes. Cthulhu seems powerless at present, but once free, he'll be invincibly powerful. Cthulhu's own motivations are incomprehensible, but his worshippers are notable for their frenzied brutality, providing another paradoxical contrast. Cthulhu is personally super intelligent, but his worshippers represent humanity at its most ignorant and bestial. Finally, Cthulhu's incomprehensible alien nature makes him representative of the greater mystery of the universe itself. The universe and the mythos enthrall with their grandeur, but appall with their inhumanity. So Cthulhu seems to sort of symbolize the unconscious mind. Now, what's interesting is, you know, when we think of Call of Cthulhu, we think of it as the game with sanity rules, right? Like, that's the joke. It's the game where everybody dies or goes insane. But actually, something very similar is replicated here in the Deities and Demigods book in the entry for Cthulhu. So we have Cthulhu, he's a greater god, he's got 400 hit points, he makes 30 attacks a round, yada yada yada, he's size large, no kidding. He's chaotic evil, which, yeah, sure, shouting and killing and reveling in joy, he's going to show you new ways to kill. New ways to shout and kill and revel in joy, right? I'm perfectly willing to believe that there are new ways to revel in joy. I'm perfectly willing to believe that there are new ways to kill, which I do not wish to know about. I'm very curious to find out what new ways to shout Cthulhu knows about, because I feel like we've got that one down. You know what I mean? Like, I feel like humanity has pretty much got shouting under control. But yeah, what do I know? Anyway, so we have a physical description of Cthulhu, which is what you're all, I'm sure, familiar with. Octopus-headed, roughly humanoid, bat-like wings. Now, interestingly, the Cthulhu entry in Deities and Demigods has a lot of information about Cthulhu's cult, which is missing from the sections on all the real deities. Well, not all, but many of the real deities could really use more information on how they are worshipped. It's so strange, because the worship of real deities ought to be easier to find out about than fictional ones, you'd think, although actually sometimes more complex than that. It's just so odd. Cthulhu gets a lot of context in a way that, like, I don't know, Zeus doesn't. Well, I don't know, we haven't done Zeus yet. Maybe it's full of stuff about the role of religion in the civic life of the classical world. I mean, I could be wrong. Anyway, I mean, no surprise, Cthulhu's a real hard nut. And I mentioned the idea of the insanity rules earlier, and they appear here. So bizarre is its construction, that is, so bizarre is the construction of Roulier, that anyone entering the city must make saving throws at +4 against fear and insanity. Cthulhu lies in a huge stone structure sealed with the Elder Sign. If the seal is broken and the god released, everyone and or everything in a radius of 100 miles must make a saving throw against death or go insane. This insanity lasts for a number of months equal to the creature's intelligence. So the smarter you are, the more you realize the nature of the existential threat that Cthulhu poses. It's not just that Cthulhu is a big, powerful monster, like the Tarrasque exists in this cosmology, but what he does is reveal the falsity and hollowness of all your beliefs, and the smarter you are, the more devastating that is to you. That's actually elegant. I gotta tell you, I'd only really skimmed this section before I started reading it for the podcast, and I'm sort of surprised by how much I like it so far. Let's talk about another thing I like. The art in this section of Deities and Demigods is mwah. It's great. It's by Errol Otis, and, I mean, no fooling, it's by Errol Otis. But he draws a wonderful Cthulhu. Cthulhu has this wonderful expression. He looks bored. And the swirly images surrounding him that kind of blend into the towers of the city of Roulier, they sort of look like screaming faces, and there's all this, like, weird alien architecture and cosmic forces, no doubt, and Cthulhu's just like, ugh, not this again. It's terrific. I maybe wouldn't have gone with the rolling eye, but other than that, just stunning. Great image of Roulier, great image of like a wild cosmic vista. Errol Otis knocking it out of the park on this one, which is good because the art in some of these sections has been a little bit hit and miss. But if you were going to put someone on the Cthulhu Mythos beat, it would be Errol Otis. So far, I think that the Deities and Demigods book is actually doing a bang-up job, right? We have approached this with the brief of presenting Cthulhu as he would be presented in a D&D campaign, i.e. as some kind of supervillain. We've even got the terrible thing that's going to happen to everybody if he awakes, right? Everybody within 100 miles is going to have to make a saving throw versus death or go insane for a number of months equal to their intelligence. Now, the bad news about that is that Roulier is traditionally in the middle of the ocean, so there's not likely to be anybody within 100 miles other than the poor fools who've gone there to stop the cult from opening the tomb. But still, Cthulhu's very presence is going to inflict this devastating blow on the minds of humanity, and we know that these dum-dums in his cult are going to Roulier to wake him up because they think that, you know, when he arises, they'll have license to just go around and be creeps to whoever they feel like, and you, whoever you are, have got to put a stop to them. One of the problems with big heroic quest narratives in Dungeons & Dragons is that a lot of people prefer to play kind of scoundrelly characters, right? And therefore, you know, and scoundrelly characters are the engine of sandbox play because they're opportunistic. They like to go and look and see, you know, hey, what's in this environment and what can I do with it? But if you want a bunch of scoundrelly or even outright villainous characters to go on a big heroic quest, you have to put them up against something like Cthulhu. It's a bit like that scene in The Rocketeer where Paul Sorvino switches sides and fights with the good guys because, like, okay, he's a criminal, but he's not a Nazi. In the same way, you'd be like, yeah, okay, look, I may be a robber or a murderer or a mercenary or a tyrant, but I don't want to end the world. I don't want to drive everyone, including myself, insane. You could be the lawful evil guy against this. I'm not letting the rabble riot in the streets and burn things down and shout. You know, we're going to have some law and order around here, or my name's not, you know, Blargar Iron Fist. And in a highly lawful society, you can absolutely imagine these secret covens of Cthulhu cultists meeting, you know, dreaming of the day when the shackles of this magical utopia are going to finally be broken and they can just go knife people in the streets and light things on fire and dance in front of the flames whether you develop that response to, you know, living in some awful iron-fisted tyranny, or whether you develop that response living in, like, you know, peaceful fantasy kingdom, whatever, you can kind of see how it would appeal to some people. And it also makes sense why, like, ordinary monsters wouldn't particularly worship Cthulhu, right? Like, orcs and whatever, like, orcs just like to beat people up and take their stuff. That's a very comprehensible motivation. We may not agree with it, we may not like it, but you can absolutely understand the desire to feel like a big, strong, tough thing and kick people in the face and take all their, like, turkey legs and gold coins and things. In fact, you could have, like, quote-unquote sophisticated humans and elves not really believe in Cthulhu, and all the sort of more primitive creatures believe in and are terrified of him. Because humans, like, lie to themselves in ways that orcs don't, you know? Orcs are very aware that there are worse things than orcs out there. It's a bit trickier with demons. I feel like if you're going to have demons in your world, you know, like, devils, absolutely, devils would hate Cthulhu. Devils are like, yeah, look, we have a system, all right? You may not like it, but we're punishing the guilty people, and you sold your soul, and the rules are the rules are the rules. The rules happen to say that you're going to be torn apart by burning chains, but I didn't make the rules, those are just the rules. As it happens, I'm going to enjoy it. But whether I do or don't, the rules are the rules. But, like, cosmologically, Cthulhu isn't necessarily that different from a demon, so you'd need to have a think if you were going to use the classic, like, demon and devil cosmology in your Cthulhu-influenced D&D campaign. And you need to think about the ways in which devils were differentiated from, or not devils, excuse me. You need to have a think about the ways in which demons were differentiated from the great old ones. Anyway, that has been the first episode of the Cthulhu Mythos series of patron deities. If you enjoyed the show and you'd like to hear more of it, all you have to do is go over to patreon.com/monsterman and subscribe at the $2 or higher level. And as soon as you do, you'll get access to the whole patron deities back catalog. There's 30 episodes just waiting for you to listen to them, plus a couple of specials about the non-human deities from the Deities and Demigods book. So it's a good time to join. Anyway, I'm looking forward to recording the next one, in which we're going to talk about Azathoth, the Demon Sultan, and the Byakki, some dudes with wings. That's on Patron Deities, a show about deities for my patrons. Thank you for listening, and thank you very much for supporting Monster Man on Patreon.